Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
In the spirit of ANU's motto, which is first to know the nature of things, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and waterways, which were never ceded. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend our respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples listening today.
I asked the Prime Minister, how good is Australia?
Please explain. I'm here to make a public statement.
Look, I'm going to shirt front, Mr. Putin.
I am a fighter and not a quitter.
I don't think I know.
And I want to thank that fellow down under.
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
G'day there and welcome to Democracy Sausage, which comes each week from the studio of the Australian National University. And it's a great pleasure to welcome, as always, with me, Dr. Maria Tafalaga, Senior Lecturer in the School of Politics and International Relations and Director of the Centre for the Study of Australian Politics. Hi there, Maria.
Hello, Mark. How are you?
Terrific. We're only a few days now away from this fairly momentous referendum vote. We've spoken a lot about it over the last 18 months or so, a bit longer. And I guess now, at the moment, things aren't looking as optimistic for those hoping for a change here than they did some time ago, because we've been sort of besieged with polls.
Yes, that's right. And I suppose the most important thing about the nature of the polls is the sort of general sort of trend or average of all of those polls. And there was another one out from the Sydney Morning Herald, or the Nine Stable, I suppose, is what we call it now, with a significantly larger sample size. Though, frustratingly, that poll was not very transparent about the actual subsamples, which also sort of showed that yes has had a slight uptick, but not enough at the moment to see a successful outcome.
Yes. I mean, I take some comfort from the fact, as was indicated to me from one pollster, that pollsters aren't completely as confident as they might be even during election periods or on other issues, that they're able to measure this as well as normal. There are sort of technical surveying problems associated with it, particularly the younger people get and the methods that are used for gathering opinions, but also just the high levels of uncertainty in the electorate. There's still people, amazingly, who haven't really engaged with it. So,
and one of the things that is actually interesting is that you do actually see quite different results depending on the type of question asked.
Yeah.
And if you present people with the actual wording on the ballot, you tend to see a greater amount of support. And I guess that's sort of, yes, what you were sort of saying about whether or not the people are really capturing young people is one of the things I was kind of complaining about, the nature of the sub-sample. Like, you know, well, how many young people, how many old people are in the sample? So therefore, like, how's that affecting the potential weighting? So it could be the case that it's not a very good sample for, you know, one demographic, so they basically extrapolate from the sample that they have. However, you know, we're talking about a sample of nearly 5,000. It should theoretically mean that they have probably done a better job.
That it's representative,
but you can have systematic bias in a sample of a million, right?
Like,
yeah,
you can, and you can have aggregated polling problems, as we saw in 2019, for example, where the trend of all of the polls showed a pretty clear Labor win, and there wasn't a Labor win at all in that 2019 election, and that brought about some changes.
That's right. That's right.
Reforms.
But, I mean, I do think that we kind of have seen enough polling companies change their methods for contacting voters. And enough of them are like much more transparent than Resolve, for example, about what they're actually doing. That I would be surprised if we sort of saw a similar polling fail that we saw in 2019. However,
or in Brexit, or in not so much in the US,
half the job is just working out which of these people is actually going to turn out.
You're going to vote, yeah, in those places.
And that's
yeah.
one of the things that introduces a great deal of noise. But you know, yeah. but I'm actually not a public opinion scholar, and I'm sure I will receive emails
for the things I have said today
from my esteemed colleagues in the academy.
Yeah, I know. I think you're absolutely right. And of course, the other issue, we'll get to our guests in just a moment, but the other issue is, which is always a concern, I think, and even a concern, in fact, for lots of voters when you talk to them, is the extent to which polling itself, the advent of polling as news stories, have an effect on the ultimate result, you know, the way they influence public opinion.
Yeah, I don't think, I mean, like, I think actually the exercise we've just engaged in is actually probably not very helpful, right? Like, you're talking down the result, there'll be people out there who might be swayed by that, or it might mean that fewer volunteers go out to door knock because it's, you know, they might feel it's not worth their while. So
I just don't think that's true of Democracy Sausage listeners, though. I think they're more engaged, civically active citizens.
You know, and you should participate in the efforts of full disclosure. You know, I've been doing that. I did a pre-poll yesterday in Monero.
Yeah.
Yes, that's right. Giving out how to vote cards and so on and so forth. And I'll be doing that again.
Well, two people have been doing a power of work in campaigning and doing so really against the consensus, indeed the official position of the opposition, are members of the opposition, one of whom actually surrendered his position as Shadow Minister for Indigenous Affairs, that being Julian Lisa, the member for Barawa. He is with us, as is Bridget Archer, the member for Bass, who is also known for having taken a number of positions against her party over a period of time, standing on matters of principle and representing in a very energetic way her electors in that Tasmanian seat of Bass. And I'm very, very proud to have both of them joining us on Democracy Sausage. Welcome to you both.
Hello, Mark.
Wonderful to be here.
So, you would have been listening to what we were just saying then, Julian. I wonder if we could start really at first principles. You're in a very good position, I think, just to give us a kind of a thumbnail sketch of where this came from, this proposition for The Voice. You've been involved with this issue and with Indigenous policy for a great deal of time. You have outstanding sort of merit in this debate, and I wonder if you could just give us, a bit of a thumbnail sketch of where, of from whence this proposition came.
This proposition came from Aboriginal people themselves. It started with William Cooper almost a century ago petitioning the King for the recognition of his people in the Constitution. In more recent times, John Howard in 1999 and 2007 put the issue of constitutional recognition on the table, and in 1999. People forget now, but the same day we voted on a republic, we voted on a preamble to the Constitution that also included Indigenous recognition among a number of other things. And then there were a series of committees that were established, an expert panel, a referendum council, to consult with Indigenous people about what they wanted from constitutional recognition. My own entry into this debate, I go back to the Constitutional Convention before the Republic referendum, where I moved a motion that we have a second question at the same time as the Republic looking at Indigenous recognition. But in more recent times, it goes to some conversations that Noel Pearson and Megan Davis and Marcia Langton had with myself and other constitutional conservatives like Greg Craven and Toomey, Damien Freeman and others, trying to work out a way in which we could thread the needle and find a proposition that Indigenous Australians and constitutional conservatives could coalesce around in order to give this proposition the best chance of support. From those discussions came this idea of an advisory body called The Voice. It was a rejection of a symbolic-only recognition of Indigenous people. It was a rejection of a judicial veto through what was known as a racial non-discrimination clause. And then a whole suite of ideas were taken to Indigenous people as part of the process of the referendum council, where Indigenous people really for the first time were deeply consulted about what they wanted from constitutional recognition. And overwhelmingly, they said they wanted recognition in the form of a voice. And Indigenous people got together after this sort of deep process of consultation at Uluru and resolved that when it came to constitutional recognition, they wanted recognition through a voice, through a committee effectively, to provide advice to the parliament, to ministers, to public servants about the policies and laws that affect Indigenous people in order to help us close the gap in some of those key areas like education, employment, healthcare and housing. And of course, in the Uluru Statement, they mention the terrible incarceration rates of Indigenous people. So it's really all about, this is a wonderful country that we live in. As we all know, Australia, you know, in any social and economic indicator performs at the very top of the world. And yet we have this gap in the performance of Indigenous Australians compared to the rest of us, that just, it doesn't matter who's in government, it doesn't matter how much money's applied to the problem, it doesn't matter what level of goodwill. There's a structural element here that prevents the gap from closing. And that structural element is a failure to properly and systemically listen to Indigenous people before we make policy that affects them. That's all this is about.
How can I ask you this, and I might get both of your impressions on this, but how difficult, because I think what you've just said there is extremely clear and makes, you know, eminent sense, right? But to a lot of people, it's almost like there are two elements to this, two hemispheres that don't need to be joined. These are people who are unconvinced so far, right? And that is, they understand the idea of recognition, which is officially what your party's position is, that Peter Dutton has declared, hence this idea of a future referendum, about which I remain profoundly unconvinced. And then on the other side is this question of the voice. And it's a fairly common message. I'd be interested in your views about whether that has made it hard to communicate. What are you hearing from, you're both members of the House of Representatives, what are you hearing from voters when you are out there campaigning, particularly given that, you know, your constituents, the majority of them are supporters of the coalition, or you wouldn't be in parliament?
Look, I think it's a reasonable question, and one that I think Julian and I have spent a lot of time responding to. I think there is broad support for that symbolic recognition, the constitutional recognition of Indigenous Australians. But what Indigenous Australians have asked for is the practical measures that will sit alongside the symbolic. Now, the symbolism is important. You know, we have all manner of symbolic things in our lives, and they're meaningful, things like flags and other things. They're
marriage.
Symbolic. Marriage, yeah, but they're meaningful. So that is important. But what Julian has just said is about the practical considerations that are going to actually change the lives of First Nations people. And that is an equity argument, I think. You know, people will say, well, we're all equal. Well, we sort of are all equal, but there's an inequity that exists between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians that Julian has just articulated. And what the voice does is seek to, and is what has been asked directly by Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, is to address that inequity that leads to those terrible outcomes that don't seem to close.
Let me add to what Bridget said, all of which I agree with. And that is, what is the point of recognising Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in the Constitution in a way that they don't wish to be recognised? I mean, there seems to be absolutely no point, because you won't get Indigenous support, and that seems to me to be a precondition for any successful referendum. Nor do I think that a purely symbolic referendum will necessarily carry the day. John Howard in 1999 put up a purely symbolic proposal, and that was voted against by more than 60% of Australians. There is, in my view, no guarantee that a purely symbolic referendum will get up. This is actually in accordance with the wishes of Indigenous people, and that's what's important here too.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. Sorry, just quickly on that, Maria. The Julian's point about the 60% opposition to it in 1999. In 1999, for example, all jurisdictions, as I understand it, voted against it. That including the ACT, which is, you know.
No, the ACT voted, on the preamble, yes, the ACT.
Yeah, on the preamble, the ACT voted for the Republic, but did not get to the 50% on the question of the preamble. So this, not that long ago, was litigated in public, and it didn't get much support.
Yeah, I think in part it reflects the sort of process that underwrit that preamble proposal, it sort of goes to what Julian and Bridget were just sort of saying about essentially listening to Indigenous people versus telling them this is what you're getting. So one of the things that I'd be really interested in your perspectives on, both of you, is one of the arguments that I hear a great deal, particularly in my sort of community, my family's from Eastern Europe, is this, you know, this great feeling of grievance amongst migrants who have basically done blue collar hard jobs for their whole lives and pay taxes and so on, is this idea that through this voice that Indigenous people will get special rights. Now, I know both of you are on the conservative side of politics. I know, Julian, you have described yourself as a constitutional conservative. You just did. So could we actually unpack why this is a misplaced fear?
I think there's two points. The first is that since Federation, there has been a power to make laws, special laws, about the people of any race for whom it's deemed necessary to make special laws. And in 1967, we had a referendum because originally Aboriginal people were carved out of that provision. But in 1967, we had a referendum where 90% of Australians voted in favour of changing the constitution to let us make laws about Aboriginal people. Since Federation, they are the only people that we've ever made special laws for. We don't make laws for Greek Australians or Italian Australians or Chinese Australians or Indian Australians or Jewish Australians or Christian Australians or Hindu Australians. But we do make laws for Indigenous Australians. They're the only people we've made special laws for. And the fruit of those laws is the gap that doesn't close. And so that's why it's important to have this particular body. It's also a recognition that Indigenous people are our first people. I mean, everybody seems to be, at least in public, saying they support that idea. So they do have a slightly different status to the status of other people. I think the other thing to say in relation to migrants who've come to Australia, who bring enormous social capital from where they've come from. They often come here, highly educated people from other places, and sometimes they do difficult jobs here that they are that don't match the qualifications that they've had in other places. But they come from cultures where you haven't had the interruption that Aboriginal people have had, and so their starting line is further along than the starting line for Indigenous people. And so this is about bringing everybody up to the same starting line.
Yeah, I would agree with that assessment. And, you know, I think that we already must recognise that we already do have special treatment, if you like, for Indigenous Australians. We have a Minister for Indigenous Australians. We have a portfolio for Indigenous Australians. There's a great deal of spending happens that's directly related to Indigenous Australians. So if we already recognise that exists because of the disadvantage that we have talked about, the logical extension of that is, if it's not working, why is it not working? And the evidence suggests, and it's why the voice is being asked for, is that perhaps if you ask the people who are affected by those special laws that you're making, you might get a better outcome. And what we have heard in our communities, and as we've moved around the country, Julian came here, for example, to Tasmania for some information sessions. We've also been hearing from First Nations people about how they're culturally unique across the country. And that is important, and it speaks to why we need to have those local and regional voices to hear directly from people right across the country who are not the same as well. So I visited Flinders Island last week and was talking to the Flinders Island Aboriginal Association, and their needs and what they might need to close the gaps in their community is going to be different to other communities across the country. And that's important. If we just apply this broad brush approach to policy making, which we have been doing for a long time, recognising that we're making special laws about Aboriginal people, we're just going to keep getting the same results.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. Let's take a quick break there and be back in a moment.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalised plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
When the wind veered, the smoke was driven backwards, revealing a most amazing scene. Standing columns of fire.
To Be Continued is a new podcast that explores the rich world of lost literary fiction from Australia's past.
It helps you to understand the way in which knowledge is kind of not something that's out there waiting to be discovered, but it's something that you create.
To Be Continued is brought to you by the Australian National University and is available now on your favourite podcast app.
Welcome back. Now, I wonder if I could go into a sort of the dimension of history here a bit, because it seems to me that a lot of the debate has proceeded from a level of a very light understanding on the part of Australian voters as a cohort to this nation's history, and indeed even really to what the Constitution says. You know, there are a lot of misnomers circulating around in this debate. Bridget, to you first, do you think there's been a sort of Maria mentioned the term civics before, I think. Do you think there has been a failure in our education system and our understanding of the nature of the Constitution and the nature of the machinery and so forth that is a vacuum into which a whole lot of misinformation has been able to sort of circulate as a result of just Australians not really having a good understanding of the true nature of Aboriginal dispossession and the legal basis of terra nullius and all of those things?
Perhaps in part. I mean, I think it is more a function, to be honest, of a particular type of political discourse that occupies the world now, the way that people consume information, the vast amount of information that's readily available, but a sort of decline in the ability of people to critically evaluate the information that's put before them as well. You know, when Julian and I were at school, probably, we were taught a lot of information, whereas I feel now there's so much information available, and we're taught how to go and access information, but I think now there's such a ready available amount of information that really we need to be reframing that to show people how to evaluate the information that they get. But I think that there's some wider issues too, just in terms of the history of Indigenous history and politics, I guess, in the country as well. And my own state is a good example of that, where, you know, probably when I was at school still, you know, and in fact, I was talking to a local Indigenous man, Nick Cameron, here last week, and he was sharing the example of when he was at school, you know, he was sitting in a class where they were teaching him that he didn't exist, that Tasmanian Aboriginal people didn't exist, you know. And so that has changed, I guess. And I've noticed even in just, you know, the 10 or 15 years that I've been involved in public political life, just how the conversation has changed in Tasmania and the willingness of people to engage with Aboriginal culture and history in a way that they never have before. I think that's a really positive thing. We're seeing dual naming, you know, here in Tasmania in increasing ways. My own children were learning Palawakani as their language other than English at school. That they're really positive changes. And I think for me, it's been actually a great privilege through the course of this debate to have the opportunity to really understand more about that history and to hear those stories and connect really deeply with the people whose history and stories that is. And, you know, I really have valued that. I think that's been a huge privilege for me.
Julian?
Look, I agree with Bridget. I think about my educational background. When we were at school, it was during the period of the 75th anniversary of the Gallipoli landings. And I remember what a huge influence that the Anzac story had on our conception of what it is to be Australian. And I think that still has a great influence. But what I see as I go around my electorate is that there is a real hunger to know more about the culture of the Darugan Guringai people, who are the traditional people of my community. What are their traditions, their customs? What was the nature of the black and white contact, both good and bad? And I think younger people, those Indigenous stories and that sense of the Indigenous story being part of the broader Australian story is going to be as significant and impactful for people as the Anzac story was for my generation, because people are just rediscovering it and learning about it and understanding it and see it as part of the shared Australian story. But I think a couple of other interesting observations from what Bridget made. We have to remember most Australians don't know we have a constitution, and those Australians that do know we have a constitution, most of them have never read it. As a constitutional enthusiast, that makes me sad. But as an ordinary Australian citizen, you actually have to think, well, it says something that's a bit good about our country, because people only need to know about their constitutions when things have gone bad and, the constitution becomes a massive matter of debate. So I think that's partly reflective of the fact that generally we have a very successful constitutional system.
But it does leave us vulnerable to an argument that is put forward with respect by your party, not by you, but by your party, it's been very successfully used in this campaign and in the Republic referendum. If you don't know, vote no. You know, a sort of arresting level of ignorance about these matters leaves us prone to that kind of, I think a dishonourable proposition, frankly.
I couldn't agree more that it's dishonourable, and it's it's disrespectful to the framers of the Constitution, who gave us as the Australian citizenry the right to change the national rulebook. In so many countries, it's parliamentarians like Bridget and I who get to make that decision, but we are fortunate and rare in this country that all of our citizens have that, and all the framers wanted, and I've quoted Edmund Barton in some of the speeches that I've made, was that we would deliberate on this seriously and get informed. And so I think it's a terrible argument. The one argument you haven't heard from the no case, though, is the argument you usually hear in referenda from the no case, which is, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And I think that's really interesting.
It is.
Because that's an acknowledgement that the system is broken. And we know it's broken because of that terrible gap that means that an Indigenous boy is more likely to go to jail than university, that one in two Indigenous Australians living at or below the poverty line, and that an Indigenous woman in my state is 30 times more likely to be a victim of domestic violence than a non-Indigenous woman. The system is broken, and we cannot let Saturday go past without the opportunity to do something to fix it.
And that's directly related to what you guys were both discussing around the importance of history, right? Because it's not just this abstract thing that you read in books. It's actually like a set of practical outcomes that create positive and negative feedback loops for people that see them caught in cycles of disadvantage or privilege, right? And I mean, you know, Julian mentioned Gallipoli. Which, why is that event so resonant for Australians? Like, it's because it's for a few reasons. One is that it's this evocative story around nationhood. Another is that actually when you ask people from their families, like lots of stories come out about like how great granddad came back and he wasn't quite the same and it changed grandma's life and, you know, things might not have been as nice anymore, or so many young people died, had a big effect on the economy, had a huge effect on public policy. It actually really changed the country and the structure. And so, and that's just one traumatic event in one generation that is affecting a country. And what you've got with Indigenous people is you've actually got a series of compounding really significant, serious, capital H history events happening to the same communities, you know, potentially one every generation, sometimes more than one. We're talking about, diseases wiping out communities. We're talking about massacres and murders. Then we're talking about moving people to literally the middle of nowhere and saying they have to stay there, talking about controlling their lives.
Taking their children.
And taking their children, right? Incarcerating them at higher rates than the average population because of a failure to understand those practical historical processes. And that's actually why listening is so vital to fixing this problem, because these things have happened because there has been no listening. There's been plenty of talking, particularly from Indigenous people. They've actually never stopped advocating for themselves, but we have not been listening, and a lot of us are doing the same thing right now. We're not listening.
Yeah, I think it's very well put. How do you – I'd be interested in all three of your views on this question. How do you think media have performed through this period? Perhaps to you first, Bridget.
Yeah, I think it's disappointing in some ways, but also I think symptomatic of the issue I was talking about earlier, where we just have this huge availability of information as opposed to fact necessarily. And, a media environment and a social media environment that no longer kind of necessarily interprets that either in a factual way. There's this tendency to kind of see just both siding without commentary as being fair or unbiased. I don't actually believe that is true. I think we've seen naked misinformation and outright lies at times go unchallenged in the name of sort of presenting both sides. I don't think that's something that we should celebrate. And, I think it is actually a bit of a threat to democracy more broadly. We have seen it through the course of this debate, but I think we see it more widely as well. And I've heard Julian speak very eloquently previously around that sort of Trumpian politics, for example. And it's the same situation, I think, that we see where you just have heaps of information, opinion, essentially presented as fact, and going just unchallenged in the ether, and being shared, and it's like a runaway train. Then I think
I'm seeing this in my community too. I mean, I think Bridget put it really well. There's too much information. I was door knocking on Sunday, and I came upon a man who said, "I've got so much information. It's not that I can't make an informed choice. I'm just bamboozled." And I think that's been the problem, is people being able to find reliable sources to see real engagement in the issues, wanting to know, because we've got to this period where when we were growing up, in our family we got the Herald and the Daily Telegraph in the morning. We watched the Channel 9 news and the Channel 2 news in the evening. That was how we consumed, and pretty much other families that grew up in and around me did similarly. Now just the news is for everywhere. There are fewer and fewer people paying any attention to the general news, and there are more and more people, less and less trust in the general news, and more people just believing rubbish that they read on the internet. I mean, I've had two different people say to me that there's actually a second constitution, that there's the Constitution of Australia Proprietary Limited, and that actually controls the Constitution. I've had Indigenous people say that.
Well, there's a news break for us.
This is just a bizarre conspiracy, but yeah, people believe it because the ability to actually deal with the information is difficult. And I think that there's a sort of a general lack of trust in the media, that this is kind of has seen people choose to go to other sources. But those sources are, hugely unreliable as well.
Yeah, I mean, Maria, between that and algorithms that are essentially curating news to people, news feeds to people, so that they are, seeing sort of spectacular takes on things, and just that whole sort of sickening pastiche of information now, where facts are competing with non-facts, but without any necessarily, sort of advantage, the advantage of being true, for example. It's just everything's weighted the same. This is sort of relativist pastiche, as I say.
Yeah, I mean, and part of it is around the problem of polarization, which we've kind of alluded to, right? And that sort of reflects. I mean, like, I just wonder if Bob Hawke could be Prime Minister today with his message of consensus. Like, what would a consensus look like in this country? You know, because people are increasingly kind of wanting their sort of feelings or opinions affirmed, and that has definitely had an effect on mainstream and legacy media. And even though people might not always be consuming those media directly, it does have an impact on the rest of the media sort of ecosystem. And the fact that a lot of journalists in this debate have really been, I suppose, reluctant to really call out questionable information, to let it sort of stand.
Or to persist in doing so, which I think is an important point here.
Yes.
I mean, I think most journalists, if you made that criticism of them, would be able to defend themselves. They would be able to cite the interview they did where they challenged it. But it needs to be challenged every time it's said, and that might not be much fun, but if campaigners for the no case, for example, are making things up or you know, putting forward massive exaggerations, conflating things together that have no relationship, then that needs to be called out, and it needs to be called out every time it's said. Not just once.
And I think it's actually a twofold problem for the average journalist. Like, one is it requires actually a knowledge of a lot of policy detail about the Constitution, which, you know, potentially a journalist doesn't have. That could be one problem.
Very good point, and it is a problem.
Yeah, and I mean, like, to be blunt, journalists are kind of paid to know this stuff, and
yes,
it's not like we didn't know this referendum was coming.
Yeah.
And the second is, like, you know, it's the elephant in the room. We don't really have very sophisticated language to kind of talk about race. You know, we talk a lot about ethnicity. That is actually a product of decades long of policy decisions, and that was done to take the kind of eugenicist capital R racism out of public policy. But it has meant that we don't always have the necessary tools to kind of discuss this question in a way that hasn't kind of descended into the conversation that we're having now. And I can imagine that there are probably many journalists out there who actually might have the facts or might have the skills and the expertise, but they are afraid of engaging in this conversation around race. And I think the example of the Marcia Langton incident that happened about 3 weeks ago is a really good example about that. And lots of people really tiptoed around the idea of, you know, really belling the cat on this issue of racism. And it was such a strange moment where more people seem to be in mainstream media upset about accusations of racism than actually kind of
than the reckoning actual practice of racism
with what Langton was trying to highlight.
And indeed, when the corrections came, they came as in Marcia Langton denies slurring no voters, as distinct from the tape recording shows she didn't slur no voters. You know, that was actually what the headline should have been.
She made a much more nuanced argument.
Yeah, and as Bridget says, nuance hasn't been really able to sort of struggle its way to the front of the peloton in this public discourse.
I think that's part of the issue too, is that the yes argument is necessarily nuanced.
Yes.
And no doesn't have to be, I guess, is the bottom
line. Yeah, no doesn't even have to be internally consistent. And this is one of the things that I've found really asymmetric about this contest, that no could have 10 different arguments which all contradict each other, which all can't be true together, but they all have had some salience out there in convincing people. We don't know. We shouldn't prejudge the result here. We're a few days from the vote. But what we can say is that the yes case has softened very significantly since the commencement, at least by way of measures of public opinion. And as you say, Bridget, nuance or complicated arguments, arguments about principle. And the other thing you'd probably have to agree is that the yes case has been determinedly positive. And that's actually been tactically a limitation on its ability to really get down in the gutter with some of these arguments.
Well, I think it's necessary because it is also, whilst it's nuanced, it's also it is hopeful.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it's hopeful for a better future. There's not a way to position it negatively in that respect, I guess. And I think part of the work that Julian and I have been doing is to try and draw out some of those arguments too when you're talking to people and just having one conversation after another conversation to people about the consistency in those arguments. You know, Yes has been very consistent in its messaging because it is what it is. The arguments on the no side, as you've said, have been lacking in consistency. They are incompatible with each other. And some of the conversations I'm having with people now is have a think about some of those arguments that have been made and what's the extension of those arguments, you know, which we talked about earlier around, well, we're all equal. Well, we're demonstrably not all equal. Where some people will get special treatment. Well, if you extend that argument, as we've said, some people are already getting special treatment. Are you saying that you don't think that they ought to get special treatment? Like, where's the logical extension of these sorts of arguments? And those are some of the conversations that, you know, certainly I have been having as, you know, if you can have those one-on-one conversations with people and you can point to the inconsistencies in those arguments, then people start to see that really what you are being asked to decide is to give Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people that symbolic recognition in the Constitution and the practical advisory committee enshrined in the Constitution to ensure that we are able to address the disadvantage that we all acknowledge exists.
Julian, can I ask you about the your colleague Andrew Bragg, who's also a yes voter, and he has made criticisms about what he says is the sort of failure to build a stronger centre ground consensus ahead of this vote, in and I suppose he's talking about here really in a parliamentary sense. Do you think there's validity to that proposition? I mean, was the government somewhat naive in thinking that the opposition was going to come on board, or did it just think that it was going to be able to defy history and get this question up without bipartisanship?
All of my participation in this debate has been focused on trying to get as many yes votes as possible for this proposition. And I think that there were definitely moments over the course of 2022 and early 2023 where, you know, if things had been handled a bit differently, there would have been more parliamentary support for the yes case. I mean, even Ivan moved amendments in the House of Representatives, not because I had issues with the proposition in a technical sense, but because I knew there were some stumbling blocks for some colleagues, and more importantly, for some voters in relation to the question. But I think, you know, we are where we are, and what gives me hope, and it's what I always try to bring people back to, is the words on the in the Constitution, because that's actually the only thing that's going to change. It's not all the distractions that the no case has suggested, like the WA heritage laws or welcomes to country or a chance to vote against the UN or whatever it is that the conspiracy theorists are saying. That's what some of the anti-vax conspiracy theorists are saying on my pre-polls.
I know, I've seen some of it.
And I mean, this is effectively what this is all a rerun of for them. This is not just a chance to vote against things you don't like in the country. There's actually a proposition on the table. That's the only thing that we're looking at. It's a proposition that completes our constitution by recognising Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in a way they've asked to be recognised, and gives us a new tool in the public policy-making armour to try and address those major gaps that we have in outcomes between Indigenous people and the rest of us. That's all this is about. And, you know, I've described the no cases approach to this like a Jackson Pollock painting. You know, Jackson Pollock famously of blue poles, like the splat of the canvas with paint. And all they've done here is gone splat Western Australian heritage laws, splat welcome to country, splat dot painting, splat, you know, treaty, splat reparation, splat, 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 splat. We've got to get back to what this is actually about, which is about that one new section of the Constitution, fewer than 100 words, but something that I think will make a big difference.
And I think that's an important point as well, because people will say, well, it's not this that's going to lead to all this, that and the other thing. It's not. It can't. It's there in black and white. But also some of those things can 100% be done irrespective of the voice or not. So people, if that's their framing, they're going to be bitterly disappointed regardless when they realise that there's already treaty negotiations going on in several states now across the country. The government could change the date of Australia Day if it wanted to. None of these things are predicated on the success or failure of this referendum. It's not what you're being asked, and there's no this will lead to that. This will do exactly what it says on the box, nothing more, nothing less.
Exactly, and there are no special rights. I mean, it is an advisory voice that would be protected in the Constitution, simple as that. And in fact, I would have preferred the word protected than enshrined all the way through, just because I think it has a stronger narrative quality to it. It actually explains that the point about it is that it is something that has been vulnerable in the past to the vicissitudes of electoral politics.
This is what happens when you get too many lawyers involved, Mark. They use legal language rather than simple language that Australians understand.
Yes, exactly. Look, thanks so much to both of you for being on. It's been really terrific having this discussion. I hope it's been useful for you if you're listening to just get more information on this. It's really important. It is a very profoundly important national moment, and it doesn't come up very often. Referendums are relatively rare. If you're younger than 42 in this country, you will never have voted in one. That tells you something right there. And rarer still are ones that actually pass. And indeed, history making it would be for one to pass without bipartisan support of both parties. So there's some big questions the country faces. People are already voting, as you said, Maria.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
You've been out there, and thanks to Julie and Lisa and to Bridget Archer. It's been really terrific having you on.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for having us.
That's Democracy Sausage for this week. We'll be perhaps a different country when we speak to you next week. And the topic to be advised, because I haven't even thought that far, to be honest. If you want to get in touch with us, our email is democracysausage@anu.edu.au. So thank you to all. I should say thanks to Jack Fox and to Angus Blackman, because I rarely do this. I rarely get around to saying thank you to them, but they provide such brilliant support, Angus Blackman being the EP of Democracy Sausage. We should always thank him, because the efforts that they put in make this thing happen, and they are expert efforts at that. There would be no pod without them. That's it. Bye for now.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.